My name is Paul Price, and I am honored to chat with Mr. Andre Deshields for the Actors Fund on Sunday, October 30th, 2016, at the Yale Repertory Theater in New Haven, Connecticut. Oral History 1 of 3. Hello, sir.
Hello.
So, I want to start off by asking you, in researching for this experience, I saw that you mentioned that seeing John Bubble Sublet in Cabin in the Sky as a boy was a seminal moment for you. So I just wanted to start off by asking, when did you know you wanted to become an actor? And did this lend itself to that?
John Sublet, whose vaudeville name was Bubbles. He was part of a vaudeville team called Buck and Bubbles. Buck would play the piano, and John would sing and sometimes dance on the piano. As a matter of fact, if you do some deep research, there is a video of the two of them doing their routine, and John Bubbles dancing on the piano, and he does on the top of the piano what we associate with Michael Jackson as the moonwalk. Yes. So there's nothing new under the sun. When did I know that I wanted to be a performing artist? I believe in my heart that when I was evicted from my mother's womb, it was part of that X and Y chromosome that makes the zygote, the child. I say this because when I was old enough to have an adult conversation with my parents, my mother confided in me that her life's dream was to be a chorus girl, and that's the term she used. She didn't say dancer, she said chorus girl. Now, my mother was born near the turn of the 20th century, so her parents were much closer to the Emancipation Proclamation than myself or any of my siblings. So understandably, my grandparents said to my mother, "No, you're not going to be a chorus girl. That's not the way for a decent colored girl to go through life, shuffling her way through life. That's part of the history we're trying to put behind us." Similarly, a conversation with my father, who said his life's dream was to be a singer. Same situation, born at the turn of the 20th century. His parents asked the question, "How do you expect to make a secure home for your future wife and children trying to be a singer?" I start my story that way because my parents deferred their dreams. And one has to ask the question, as Langston Hughes did in the poem Harlem, what happens to a dream deferred? In this case, those deferred dreams ultimately were expressed in the 11 children that make up the Deshields clan. I consider myself lucky number 9 because my earliest conscious thought was to be an entertainer. Performing artists was a bit sophisticated at that time because we were the fans of folks like Sammy Davis Jr., people who performed instinctually. When I was growing up in Baltimore, Maryland, as I'm sure every black neighborhood across the country had, a street that was the cultural spine of the neighborhood. In Baltimore, it's Pennsylvania Avenue. And on that street would be any number of venues where you would go for your social life. The Royal Theater is where our community got their entertainment, not only through films, but as part of the Chipman Circuit. So the talent that would come to Baltimore, Billie Holiday, Duke Ellington, Pinkney Markham, Flip Wilson, the Motown Review, would all come to the Royal Theater. You could go to the movies for 25 cents then. You could go in at 9 o'clock in the morning and there would be what we called coming attractions. We call them trailers now. And then there would be a newsreel. We were beyond the Second World War, but I'm growing up in Baltimore and the Korean War is going on. So there would be a newsreel about what our soldiers were doing on the Southeast Asian Peninsula. And then there would be comics, cartoons, and then the feature would play. And that would be continuous. So from 9 o'clock to noon, all of that would happen. And then we'd start all over again. And there was no one there to say, get out of the theater. If you want to see it again, you have to pay again. You could go in for 25 cents at 9 and come out at 9 o'clock in the evening, which is how our parents knew where we were. We weren't what they call the latchkey children. Our parents knew, here's your quarter. They knew we were going to the Royal Theater at 9 in the morning, and at 9 at night, we were coming home. No concerns, no worries. Otherwise, now, more often than not, the feature films were westerns, for instance. Hopalong Cassidy, Roy Rogers, Dale and his Horse Trigger, Gene Autry, Lash LaRue, or they would be science fiction. The most sophisticated of which was Flash Gordon. I always wanted to play Mean the Merciless. And then there would be a film starring Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire. So the point I'm trying to make is there were very few opportunities for me to see myself reflected on the silver screen. One Saturday, I go with a couple of friends of mine to the Royal Theater, and the feature is Cabin in the Sky. Now, Cabin in the Sky starred probably what was every major black star of the late 40s, early 50s, including Lena Horne, Eddie Rochester Anderson, Ethel Waters, Bill Bailey, Louis Armstrong, Stephen Fetchett, Mantan Moreland, and others. So this was an amazing event for me to see all that chocolate pageantry. It was difficult to stay in my seat because this is what I hadn't really expressed it in verbally. It was just a sort of psychological feeling. I'm enjoying these movies, this entertainment, but how come nobody looks like me? That sort of thing. And then when it finally happens, I could hardly stay in my seat. Little did I know that the epiphany had yet to come. And the epiphany was John Suplett, John Bubbles, performing as Domino Johnson, I think that's the correct character's name. Domino Johnson, of course, he's the badass guy. He's the sporting wife. But he's the one that's resplendent in white from head to toe, and he's got a cane, and he's wearing diamonds on his fingers, and spats on his shoes, and that sort of thing. And all the women fall out when he walks into the bar. And of course, his figure is satanic. He starts the conflict in the film. But when he does this amazing tour de force dance, where the bar has swinging doors, so the doors open, and then he insinuates himself, and he dances across the top of the bar and up a flight of stairs. And in my young mind, perhaps I was 9 years old, in my young mind, it was as if he was consumed in the clouds, like an assumption. And I enjoyed the entire film, but that's what was emblazoned, not only in my mind, but in my heart. So those deferred dreams that my parents had planted in my soul had now become legitimized because I had experienced epiphany. Because while sitting there, you know that little voice that lives in our gut that we hardly ever listen to because the ego takes over and says, the ego's like a chattering magpie, says, who do you think you are? How dare you think you're going to be a performer? If you can ever settle, even just for a few moments, and get rid of the distractions, you'll hear that small voice, which tells only the truth, but it doesn't shout like the ego does. And at that moment, experiencing John Bubbles, that voice said to me, Andre, that's what you're going to do. So that's my John Bubbles epiphany story.
So you alluded to it a little bit in that story. You talked about growing up in segregated Baltimore, right? When you were younger, did the world of the arts feel like a world that was open to you? After you had that experience, what were the realities for you in finding and navigating your way through that, from that time?
When I talk about growing up in Baltimore, I'm talking about one of the most segregated cities in the United States of America, then and now. I'm also talking about the South. Now, sometimes that surprises people. They say, Baltimore's not in the South. Oh, yes, it is. It's not in the deep South. It's not Biloxi, Mississippi. It's not Mobile, Alabama. It's not Birmingham. However, if you understand your history and your geography, the southern states are designated by geographical coordinates, longitude and latitude. Anything below the Mason-Dixon line is the South. Anything above the Mason-Dixon line is the North. Now, this is what people either knew and forgot or never did know. The Mason-Dixon line is a virtually straight line, which is the southern boundary of Pennsylvania. So anything south of that is the South. And the first state below that line is Maryland. And the first major city south of that line is Baltimore. And if you consciously travel from anywhere in the North to Baltimore, you will feel and you will see the culture change. It'll get slower. You'll see the sun in the sky from a different angle. You'll see the vegetation change. I mean, it's the way slaves made their way to freedom from the South. They knew that when there were no more magnolia trees, that they were closer to the Mason-Dixon line. And that Negro spiritual followed the drinking gourd, which meant nothing to our white masters, but the drinking gourd is the Big Dipper, and in the handle of the Big Dipper is the North Star, etc. That kind of thing. That's just evidence that Baltimore is a southern city and Maryland is a southern state, and it was torn asunder by the Civil War. Half the state were in blue uniforms for the North, and half the state were in gray uniforms for the rebels. It was literally a situation of brothers fighting brothers. I give you all of that information because I grew up in what we now call the inner city. When I was growing up, we called it the ghetto, and previous to that, it was called the slums. Third world in the 20th century, that kind of thing. When I would express my affinity for the arts, people would snap. You know, almost get whiplash. What you talking about? What kind of crazy nigga are you? The arts and entertainer, who? You think you Sammy Davis Jr.? Etc. That kind of thing. All because that kind of dreaming seemed so far away. We couldn't get a handle on it. Because we had bought into the idea that we didn't deserve, we were subhuman, and we would never have an opportunity to pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps because we didn't have any boots, kind of thing. At the same time, I understood that my authority figures were cautioning me against that, simply so that I wouldn't end up with a broken heart. But I'm talking about a child of destiny. That's what I believe. When I was imprinted with the deferred dreams of my mother and father, there was no choosing to do. There was nothing else for me to do but become the manifestation of those dreams. There was no outlet in Baltimore in the 50s and the 60s for someone who did that kind of dreaming. There is a venue in Baltimore called the Arena Players, which is one of the oldest regional theaters in the country. However, it's a community theater. Now, I'm not dissing that, but in terms of what my dream was to become professional, and the Arena Players are still there, but it doesn't offer you membership in the union, it doesn't offer you any protection in terms of medical insurance, pension and welfare, that sort of thing. So the best you could do is to get together with your buddies and do some play acting, that sort of thing. My dream was always more serious than that. So I kept it close to my vest because I didn't want it sullied by people doubting that I could make it. Also, you understand, I grew up at a time when white was not only might, it was right. And everything I did, everything I said, had to be thought of as a reflection of the race. You are representing the race in what you do and what you say and where you go and how you dress, in the things that you choose to do. So we were being encouraged then to go into science, because that was the that was the horizon we had never made an impression on. And I was in my neighborhood, I was the sharpest knife in the draw, as it were. And I got teased for it, and I got bullied for it, and all that sort of stuff. But I realized at an early age that we all had built those walls that were keeping us in the ghetto, and that we couldn't overcome. So it was, I knew that I could draw encouragement and compliments by saying to my elders, oh yes, I want to be entrepreneurial. I want to go into biochemistry. When I grow up, I want to go to college. I want to attend MIT. I want to get an MBA. I want to go into business for myself. All while knowing that what I wanted to do was dress up in fine clothes and dance on stage and act and be what they call a fool, that sort of thing. So it wasn't until high school that I could really share with my peers that this is the track, this is the path that I wanted to be on. And by the time I went to high school, I had stopped going to historically black schools because I knew I could get a better education in a school that was at the very least integrated, at the very least. But the school I attended was predominantly white. I'm a product of Thurgood Marshall and his Brown versus the Board of Education win in the Supreme Court. And it was a tangible result after he won that case, because the public schools that I had attended in grade school and junior high school all of a sudden got better materials. Now, by better materials, I simply mean our books weren't falling apart. They were less ragged because they had come from a white school that no longer had need for it. That was the reward on many levels of Brown versus the Board of Education. But I knew that if I wanted the best education that I could get, I needed to go where white students were attending. And this was a wake-up call for me. This was a cold shower for me. I said before that I was the brightest bulb in the chandelier, right? When I went to this predominantly white high school, I was incapacitated for a while by the realization that I wasn't smart. I was just the smartest person in the ghetto. Compared to these, and I went to an all-male high school where they called us by that last name and we were encouraged to wear ties and jackets to school, that sort of thing. And these white boys who had taken entitlement and privilege for granted, they knew everything. They had been exposed to culture. And I'm going there going, oh, I don't know anything. So that was a long fall from being the brightest to being the dullest. So that gave me more reason not to share my dream of being Mantan Moreland or Stephen Fetchit, as it were. It wasn't until college, and I was the first to go to college on part scholarship and part work study program because of the historical affinity that Quakers have had for Negroes. The Central Scholarship Bureau saw me, saw that I was a young colored boy with potential, but I was about to rot on the vine because I didn't have the material stuff to rise. And they chose me and said, we see your potential and we would like to help you. And we would like to give you a scholarship. But the condition is that you must attend the college of our choosing. And it was a Quaker school in southeastern Ohio, Wilmington College. That is where, in my sophomore year, one of the, James Marty Gilbert, one of the instructors in the theater department, came to me and said, I have always wanted to do Raisin in the Sun on this campus, but we've never had the talent to do it. You're my Walter the Younger. Now, I wasn't studying theater, but again, he saw my parents' deferred dreams in me. Now, I had the dream to be an entertainer. I had the epiphany when I saw Cabin in the Sky. Now I was about to get the training so I could say without any consternation, I'm going to be an actor. I'm 19 years old, sophomore at Wilmington College, playing Walter the Younger in Raisin in the Sun. It's a combination of students on the campus and talent from the town, that kind of thing. So this is encouragement for my family, who get on the bus as I did to get to Wilmington College and come to see me. Greyhound bus from downtown Baltimore makes its first stop in Pittsburgh, Breezeway, and then heads to Ohio. My mother, my sister represented the family there. And their realization was, wow, Andre really can entertain. So that was the final piece of the puzzle. The legitimization of the dream and the epiphany and the deferred desire on the part of my parents.
So that's a beautiful story. Were there any mentors, you would say, then to, let's move it up to now, any mentors you've encountered along the way that you felt have left an indelible mark on you and shifted the course of your career?
As I tell this narrative, what's popping up in the Rolodex of my mind are those people who served as mentors. Probably not even deliberately, but as I mentioned before, they saw this young colored boy has something, let's encourage it as much as we can. James Owings, who was one of my teachers in grade school, who knew that I was carrying some kind of seed, because whenever the time would come around for pageants, for instance, we used to wrap a maypole. I don't know if students do that any longer, but who wanted to design the maypole? I raised my hand. President Day would come around. Who wants to play Abraham Lincoln? I raised my hand. You know, we'd make a little fuzzy black beard, Christmas would come around. Who wants to play Santa Claus? I'd raise my hand, that kind of thing. And each time I would do that, I would get, sometimes literally, but always, but more often than that, metaphorically, a pat on the back. Good work, Andre, you're going far. That sort of thing. He was the first person outside of my family that I got, that I felt had my back, that was pushing me along. And 2016, he's still in my life. I see him every time. Do you know about the National Black Theater Festival in Winston-Salem, North Carolina? It happens biennially every second year, odd numbered years. I see him at the National Black Theater Festival. He comes to see me work. I think he must be in his early 90s now. And he's, you know, he's slow and he's not spry any longer. And maybe he's counting the days until he goes to his just reward, that kind of thing. But we communicate. And when we are in a situation of strangers, he says, "This is Andre DeShields. He was in my class at John Hurst Public School 120. And he's the pride of our neighbor," etc., that kind of thing. Now we jump to college. James Marty Gilbert, who said to me, "I want you to be Walter the Younger." In that simple sentence, he became a mentor for me. Now, I started college in 64, so my sophomore year would have been 66. James Marty Gilbert is still in my life. He comes to see me work. He and his wife, Midge, Mercedes is her actual name, but we call her Midge. He and his wife, who was also an instructor of theater at Wilmington College, would cast me as often as they could. Midge is no longer with us, but James is still here. And the last time I saw James was 2014. He came to see me in the Jungle Book. Now, the other mentors are more contemporary than that. Certainly, Jeffrey Holder, who costumed and directed me in The Wiz, was a mentor. Alfred Prizer, who was the founding artistic director of the Classical Theater of Harlem, was a mentor. Because when I finally became a professional performer, the modicum of success I achieved was as a song and dance man. The Wiz, Ain't Misbehavin', The Full Monty, Play On. Alfred Prizer, after I'd come back from London, doing 7 months of The Full Monty on the West End, so this is September of 2002. A friend of mine says to me, "Andre, you've got to go up to the Classical Theater of Harlem and see Jean Genet's The Blacks." Now, I had known about that play by Jean Genet, but I had no idea what the Classical Theater of Harlem was. So I went uptown, St. Nicholas and 145th, and I'm sitting in the theater, and the play is outrageously metaphysical, and it's in your face, and it is life-changing. The intermission comes up, and I'm just about to slide out of my seat to go to the bathroom, and this young white man walks up to me and says, "Oh, Mr. DeShields, I'm so glad you've come to the Classical Theater of Harlem. I said, oh, thank you very much. He introduces himself as Alfred Prizer, the founding artistic director. And he says, without missing a beat, he says, would you ever consider working with us? Now, the Classical Theater of Harlem maybe had 60 seats, right? And it was truly what we would call a hole in the wall, but they were doing deep theater, Harlem School of the Arts. Now, I have a boilerplate response to situations that I think, no, this is not for me. To extract myself from the situation, but not insult the person who is soliciting me. So I said, well, Alfred, if you ever come up with a project that you think will benefit from my participation, let me know. Meaning, no, right? Without a beat, he pulls his script from under his arm. And he says, I'd like you to take a look at this. So I'm trying to keep my cool now. So I open the script. It's Derek Walcott's Dream on Monkey Mountain. So I say, okay, let me take it home and read it. Now, I had read it before, but I just didn't want to stand there and say, I'll do it. So I take it home and I reread it because I wanted to be sure. I didn't want to say yes and then later on find out that I'm not making much money and say, you know, I can't go through it. So I reread it and I am, as the English would say, gobsmacked. Because now that I have the script in front of me and I can page through it, I can go back and reread something that I didn't quite understand, I'm realizing that this is the black man's King Lear. And not only do I want to do this, I must do this. So I go back to Alfred Prizer and I say yes, which then leads into 5 collaborations with Alfred Prizer. Dream on Monkey Mountain, Caligula, King Lear, an adaptation of Molière's Tartuffe called Archbishop Supreme Tartuffe, and then Langston Hughes' Black Nativity. So this is a crossover for me out of musical theater into dramatic theater, and that's why Alfred Prizer is in my book of mentors. Another young man who mentored me when I was his teacher, I did a distinguished visiting professorship at Southern Methodist University, and the agreement was that I would create something for the graduating students as a kind of present for their having gotten through the program. It was offered to me because I was an undergraduate friend of the gentleman who had then become the chair of the department. The class, number 12, with one African-American. So I'm thinking, what do we do here? So we created a piece based on Toussaint Louverture being the architect of the slave revolution on the island of Saint-Domingue that ultimately defeated Napoleon's navy of 30,000. Now everyone's thinking, oh, this one African-American who was over 6 feet tall and massively built and handsome, that sort of thing, was going to be Toussaint Louverture. No, I cast the white boy. Because in a situation like that, this is your last production before you leave college with your MFA. You have to be challenged. You must be challenged. That's the reason for doing something like this. So I had these 11 white students playing African slaves, you know, wearing cowrie shell, G-strings, you know, doing gang, that sort of thing. And of course, the one African-American played the king of the nation of people who had been kidnapped from the west coast of Africa, etc. One of the young men said to me in a conversation, quite boldly, "What are you doing here teaching us when you should be doing the classics?" And I'm thinking, who's this smart aleck? So I said to him, "When you have your theater, call me and we'll do the classics." We finish our project, the school loves it, I leave. That's 1991. 1996, my phone rings. It's that young man who had challenged me. He was now a professor of theater at SUNY Buffalo State College. He was about to found on campus the Oasis Theater, and his first play was Death of a Salesman. So he calls me and he explains that to me, and he says, "Remember that conversation we had?" I said, "Yes, I remember." He says, "You're my Willie Loman." And I said, "I guess I have to show up, because I said, when you have your people, we can do the classics." And this young man turned me inside out. And we did Death of a Salesman. And one of the reviewers wrote, and I'm reading the review, and my heart is sinking. His review starts, "You might wonder why," and he calls the director's, writes the director's name, "chooses a dancer to play Willie Loman," right? And then the review goes on, and by the end of the review, the critic has said, "It's a genius concept because Mr. DeShields can physically express some of the psychology that goes on in a Willie Loman's head that you can't express mentally." I'm like, yes! And this young man did all of that. And we are still best friends. As a matter of fact, when we're together, we tell people we are brothers from another mother, right? He's a mentor of mine. And then there's the gentleman who gave me my first directing gig at the Victory Gardens in Chicago. It was George C. Wolfe's Colored Museum. Now, I had performed at Victory Gardens. And this was another one of those telephone calls out of the blue. The artist director calls me, and I said, "Yes, oh yes, et cetera." He says, "I'm doing the Colored Museum, and I want you to direct it." And I think, "You want me to direct it?" He says, "Yes, it's going to be difficult, but I'll be there by your side. You can do it." Long story short, I did. I went to Chicago. I directed it. This is 1987, and I won the first of my three Joseph Jefferson Awards. So these are the people who have mentored me, always in a situation that comes out of the blue, and it's a huge challenge to which I must rise, and after rising to the challenge, I graduate.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, from all these mentors, these performances that you've done, tell us a little bit about a role that you've done that really stuck with you over the years. I see that you've brought here today a bookmark from a production of The Gospel According to James, written by Charles Smith. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that, production.
I do want to talk about it. Because more often than not, when I am asked the question, what role has influenced your life and your career? What role was it that you most wanted to do? Previous to doing The Gospel According to James, my answer would have been, I would love to do The King and The King and I. I think for obvious reasons, if you know Andre de Shields, it's a regal role. I can pull myself all the way up and it still wouldn't be too much. And also, my idol as a young boy, which most people would say, oh, must have been Sidney Poitier, it must have been James Brown. My idol was Yul Brynner. Then, in 2009, yes, that's when Barack Obama became the president of the United States and served his first term.
Right.
I had already worked with Chuck Smith, not to be confused with Charles Smith. Chuck Smith, who is the artistic associate at the Goodman Theater. I had worked with him. He had consistently directed the plays of Charles Smith, who's head of playwriting at Ohio University in Athens, in Chicago, both at Victory Gardens Theater and at the Goodman. Charles Smith, the playwright, was commissioned by the Indiana Repertory to write a piece inspired by an event that happened in 1930, which changed the history of the United States of America and needed to be expressed in dramatic literature. This event happened in Monroe, Indiana, a small town outside of Indianapolis. If anyone has ever seen that iconic photograph of a white mob standing and smiling as if they were at a picnic and looking up at a tree from which the bodies of young black boys was hanging, having been lynched, will know the story I'm about to tell. There is a song that was made famous by Billie Holiday. It's called Strange Fruit. Southern trees bear strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. So the poplar tree is a tall tree with strong branches, from which black men and women were lynched in the Deep South. Imagine in your mind's eye the lynched person hanging with the broken neck from the noose from the poplar tree, and then you get this horrific image of strange fruit. The song Strange Fruit is usually attributed for its writing to Billie Holiday. Billie Holiday did not write Strange Fruit. She simply emblazoned it in America's consciousness by the profound resonance she breathed into the lyrics. The lyrics were actually written, the song was actually written by a Jewish gentleman whose name is Abel Meeropol, who had witnessed that scene I just described and was inspired to write that poem, which was then put to music and given to Billie Holiday to sing. Just as a sidebar, Abel Meeropol is also known for having adopted the children of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, who were executed as American spies in the 30s, I do believe. All right, so that's the song. Four boys were arrested for having alleged for having molested a young white woman, which is what all of those stories about lynchings were based on. The white man had to protect the chastity of the white woman. These are trumped up charges. However, a mob hunted down the four boys and was stringing them from trees. The fourth boy, his name is James Cameron, not the director of Avatar, young black boy, prayed to save him from being hanged from a tree. And after the other three boys were lynched and they got to him, his prayers were answered. And to this day, no one has a rational explanation of this. But when they went to lynch him, the rope broke. And his life was spared. And the white crowd, you can imagine, as mentally dim as they would have to be to want to lynch young black boys, thought this, and being Christian, thought this was an act of God, and that this boy, not that he was innocent, not that he didn't deserve punishment, but that he must be spared because God had given a vision. James Cameron lived to be 93, I do believe, and founded a Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee. James is no longer with us, and once he died, the museum was not kept up, so it is now a virtual museum. The items that he collected still exist, but it's no longer in a hard piece of real estate. It's now a virtual museum, and the pieces are online. Charles Smith, the playwright, was commissioned to write a story on all of that information I just shared with you. And when he chose his director, Chuck Smith, the two of them came to me with this gift and said, we would like you to create the role of James Cameron in the world premiere of The Gospel According to James at the Indiana Rep. This was another one of those moments where I had to dig deeper toward the core of my soul than I'd ever had before. This was not going to require any dancing. This wasn't going to require any singing. This was going to require exchanging my soul for that of this man who at the age of 16 almost was lynched and then spent the rest of his life telling that story, writing a book, and collecting as many items from that experience to create this Black Holocaust Museum. And as if that were not enough, he spent his life in the judicial system, fighting for himself and those other three boys to be pardoned. And in order to do that, he had to go back to Monroe and face the people who had attempted to hang him. Ultimately, he achieved that goal. And that was a training for me, as if I'd spent 4 years being formally trained how to become an actor. Resuscitating those experiences and resurrecting James Cameron's life has left an indelible school of thought, actually, in how I prepare for roles to this very day.
Great. Thank you, Andre. Thank you so much. We have to close it here for this one, but we'll have on to the next, our next meeting. Thank you so much.
Thank you.